the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette. This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you listening to the show this month and every month. Happy New Year. If ever you've got a question you'd like to be on this program, email that to ask@wbaa.org and tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, Happy New Year to you as well.
Yeah, you too.
And let's get right to it. There's a lot to cover that's happened in the last month, and let's dispense with some of these things. There's been a lot of talk in the Indiana legislature this year about an issue that you encountered a fair amount that didn't actually go very far when you were governor, which is Sunday alcohol sales. And I got to thinking about the conversation that you and I had late last year about the creation of one Purdue-branded beer, the possibility that there would be others to follow, and I couldn't help but wonder— did you, with all of the contacts you had in the State House or any of the lobbyists for the university, figure out that this was probably going to be the year that we allowed Sunday alcohol sales and go, boy, we should strike while the iron is hot?
I wish I were that far-sighted. Nope, never thought of it at all. You know, I have to say that we had so many other plans and ideas and hopes and initiatives that I never went near this issue during 8 years in public service. It was always floating around, and we always thought there were bigger things to work on. So it's probably, if they tidy it up now, I guess it's probably a good thing. But it was never anywhere on our agendas, and we had long agendas. I will mention, I am really pleased that something that we worked on and didn't get too far, which is to say local government reform. Trying to modernize Indiana's very antiquated system of thousands of elected officials and little units of government.
You're talking about township trustees and the like.
Townships, well, also the all the county offices that we still elect and so forth. Very ironic that a state like this has more elected officials or had more elected officials than any in the country. And we had a bipartisan commission led by former Governor Kernan and Chief Justice Shepard that made 27, I believe it was, really good suggestions. But it's hard to get people to work on that, and we only got about 7 of them done. But I'm very pleased to see that this General Assembly appears to be on its way to consolidating at least a lot of the smaller townships. It's really in the public interest and the taxpayers' interest. And so sometimes ideas that you put in play don't happen right away, but eventually can occur, and I hope that's going to be one example.
Are there other issues that you've particularly been watching or the university has particularly been watching this legislative session?
Not really. Been a calm couple 3 or more years down there, and that's okay. You can't be dealing with massive change every year, as which was our experience. But I think as far as we can tell, that things are in good shape in Indiana. You see the state at the top of the list of best run government in America from CNBC. I saw, which we'd won before. It's clearly one of the few AAA credit states fiscally, top list of people's list for business climates. They made the Amazon finals,
for
instance. So, you know, there's a lot of problems, especially on the education and training side, and they're working on those, and we're happy to try to help. But when you shake it all up, this state is in a very competitively strong position now, and we need to all pull together to get better.
Just now, as we're sitting here, it occurs to me to ask you, there's been a lot of Sturm und Drang about the Family and Social Services Administration and the former director of that leaving, perhaps with some acrimony with Governor Holcomb, but now she's back working for the Attorney General. And I wondered, how does that – is there a downstream effect if there are worries about some of the underprivileged, especially children in the state? How does that, if at all, affect higher education institutions? And are you looking at that long term from a Purdue perspective?
Listen, I have very strong views about this. Nobody else seems to remember this. I created the Department of Child Services. It was – that function was buried in a massive social service bureaucracy when we came to office. And we had pledged that we would pull it out It was too important, the protection of the lives of children. And we would create an agency, and it would report directly to the governor. And that's what happened, first by executive order, then by a statute we got the legislature to pass. In the first year, 2005, that I served, the state was had seven unbalanced budgets in a row, was running a big deficit every year, and owed the schools and localities and universities $800 million. In the tightest budget in 55 years, I asked for one increase. It was for Child Protective Services. And we doubled the number of caseworkers. And we lowered the ratio of caseworkers to cases to below the national target. And in 2011, the Annie Casey Foundation gave Indiana the award for the best child services in America. Now, I don't know much past 2012. I do know that at the time, one of the reforms they were working on hard was to be careful not to take children unnecessarily out of their families or maybe their extended families. And it appears that that policy may have been reversed in the intervening years because, as we've seen, Indiana is spending way more per capita than any neighboring state, taking far more children away from their extended families than any neighboring state. So it's a good thing, I think, if this all gets a good review. That appears to be going on. But I care very deeply about this because we worked very hard on it and saw lots and lots of progress.
Have you noticed any noticeable effect on Purdue, or are you looking at a possible effect if any of these worrisome things that Mary Beth Bonaventura talked about continue?
Sure. We cannot have children endangered. And children who are endangered or in these very uncertain transitory arrangements cannot possibly do as well in school and prepare themselves for a college or the workforce in the way that they deserve to. So it's all very bound up in our need to, in our hopes of having a state of highly productive citizens ultimately. So I'm very glad it's – I don't know who's responsible for any problems that have come up. But all I can tell you is that our experience from 2005 – generally seen one of the worst in America, to winning the national award for best in America, shows that you can make real progress in this area on behalf of kids. And if we need some repair work, let's see that it happens.
On to other things, since we last talked to you, Purdue announced that it plans to name its new online university, Purdue Global. The last we spoke, you were still waiting on final approval from the Higher Learning Commission. I wanted to check in with you. It was my understanding that at some point they might come back and give you some guidance about what they thought from their campus visits, which they had in the fall. Has that guidance come back to you yet?
No, it hasn't. As recently as this morning, we were talking about it, and we've submitted everything some time ago and have not really had feedback yet. So we're waiting. But as you're quite right about the name. As you'll recall, we were specifically asked by both the state and the federal authorities to and the Higher Learning Commission to choose a name ahead of time. If they hadn't asked, we probably would have waited. We don't want to look presumptuous in any way. But they were curious to know, and the Department of Education in Washington specified that Purdue's name had to be in it somewhere. So that sort of narrowed down the range of choices and led to the one that was finally made.
Let me ask you generally about a philosophy that you've talked about in online education, and you've mentioned this at a couple of different places. You've talked about the pajama test, the idea that online universities now compete with terrestrial universities in such a way that you on the West Lafayette campus have to provide an education in some ways that stops people from just taking classes in their pajamas, in their bedrooms, sitting in front of the television or something like that. And so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking that, as you think about what is entailed in a college education, certainly there's a lot that goes into being on the campus, being around other people, playing intramural sports, going to the dining hall, things like that. And I was curious to know your general philosophy on advertising the merits of that part of the college experience versus the online experience, which it would seem to me can't quite match the things you get from a residential collegiate time.
We agree completely. I think you're exactly right. And we are working all the time here to make sure we are adding value educational experience in a way that cannot be replicated in some less expensive remote fashion. So that's everything from the learning communities, which are now a high percentage of our students live in, emphasis on mentoring, which is now part of our tenure and promotion policy and very much an expectation for all the teaching that happens here. You're going to see a lot of emphasis on teaching over the next year or two, making sure that that's of high quality as possible. Creating a diverse student body where students can learn from each other and from the different life experiences that come together here. All that and many, many other things. Now, when you think about Purdue Global, as with all other questions, you've got to start by reminding yourself who we're talking about. And that population that studies there today and will tomorrow overwhelmingly is a different population who don't have the chance, really. Life is not going to permit them, whether they want to or not, to come to a residential campus at the age of 30, 35, 40.
Right, older students returning to their
education. Older students completing an education they didn't finish before or maybe going into higher ed for the first time. And so it's for a completely different audience, but an equally deserving audience. But it leaves the big question you brought up. For that traditional age student who does have the option, are we providing value per dollar they're spending that unquestionably makes it worth their while to come and live with us for 4 years or thereabouts? And
does that mean that you don't have plans to advertise an online education to the traditional 18 to 24 year old student?
Probably not. They're probably on a very limited basis, if at all. Now, what we do want to become even better at is using online for our on campus students. Online could be part of summer study where students could move more quickly. They could be taking a course or two consistent with, let's say, working for the summer or doing other things they want to do.
And I know of several people who have done the 3-year degree plan who are doing exactly that.
That's right. So there are plenty of overlap there. But our goal is to be provide a tremendous educational experience in its fullest sense for the traditional age student without leaving abandoned those who missed it the first time and having a way for them to get some kind of a credential themselves.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Email questions at any time to ask@wbaa.org and tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. You recently did your annual open letter to campus, and I wanted to talk about an office that a lot of people, I think, probably haven't heard of, which is this Transform Purdue office that's only been in existence for a year or two. And it, I think, if I'm reading it correctly, stands to make a fair amount of news probably in the next couple of years, because there's a lot of streamlining, modernizing that's planned under the auspices of this office. And one of the things you talked about in your letter is taking the large number of job titles, 8,500 or so of them across campus, and reclassifying people, trying to get that down closer to about 1,200 was your estimate. And you said you're going to try and grandfather in existing salaries. And then I was trying to think of what would happen after that. If people were to leave their jobs and you bring people in to fill those positions going forward, does that mean that might be a standardized and perhaps lower salary level going forward for some of those jobs as you eliminate the gradations therein?
Yeah, it could mean that. I mean, it's as I tried to point out, this is primarily a fairness issue. We have people doing what appears to be identical work, some being paid substantially more than others just because they happen to work in a different unit. There's been no system here over time. Every unit, college, and whatever place you're working has been making up its own titles, making up its own pay scales. And we have people jump from one place to another just to do the same work just because they can get paid more. So that's That's really a fairness issue first, and it, and by the way, it's an efficiency issue too. But the people in the jobs today didn't create this system, and so we've got to protect them. But we want a system looking forward, which is fair and which also shows to people what they're, how they can have a logical career path, and which defines what the next level and the next level and the next level of job expectations are, so that people can lay hope, prepare for them, and advance in a rational way, not sort of the chaos that we've had too often up to now.
So there's a lot, for instance, of support staff on the campus, everything from administrative assistants to people who help out in labs and stuff like that. How do you define whether all administrative assistants are created equal, what their pay should be if there is a base level for that? And then how do you tell them, well, here's how you might be able to advance in your career if you start out as an administrative assistant?
Well, you just defined the goal very, very well. A ton of work has already gone in looking at jobs one by one and category by category to see what people are actually doing, what's expected of them, and grouping together like with like. It won't be perfect, and there's no attempt at false precision. There'll be bands or ranges around these jobs, and you know, surely we can and should get to a system which is fairer to everybody, and which is much more efficient from the standpoint of the overall institution.
Do you think this might lead to some positions just being done away with and not refilled through attrition?
I think that's a separate question. This should always be the question one asks. When a position comes vacant, the first question should be, do we need to fill it? Or could those responsibilities be shared among people who are already here, possibly compensating them more, a little more for doing so? You would hope that just as a matter of good practice, people will do that. But no, I think this has a very different objective, which is the one I've already described of greater equity and more efficiency over time in the way we spend our money.
There was an editorial recently in the Purdue student newspaper I wanted to ask you about, and the author took you a little bit to task about the over-enrollment of the dorms in the past couple of years and the fact that people have had to spend a little bit of time trying to find permanent housing. The university's been subsidizing some of the apartments that some of these students have been living in. And one of the questions that the editorial writer seemed to ask, I wanted to put to you here, which is, are there plans to create more, especially underclassmen dorms to house those people if you continue to be at this level of enrollment, or indeed grow it from here forward?
I thought it was a very fair criticism. So, clearly, these are issues we've been working on ourselves. We quite agree that we need to address them. Let me point out at the beginning the consequence, very direct consequence, of some successful initiatives. We've had a big initiative to try to grow the student population while preserving or improving academic quality. And that has worked. We have far more students than we did just a few years ago. Secondly, we've had a very concerted effort to encourage students to live on campus, where we know, on average, they do better academically. And both those things have succeeded. For example, the reapplication rate for on-campus students, freshmen who want to stay sophomore year, sophomores who want to stay junior year, has gone way up.
Now, do you mean stay in the dorms?
I'm sorry, in our on-campus okay. residence. Yes, thank you. So these are exactly the goals we were shooting at. When they all happened at the same time, they did create a real crunch. And so we're working on that. I have asked the housing people for a very clear plan this year that minimizes, as I hope to zero, but minimizes the number of freshmen who don't live on campus. You know, many other schools, possibly most, either require freshmen to live on campus or give them first preference. And we've never done that at Purdue. It's not clear to me why. We will probably, to address this problem, make adjustments in that and perhaps find a way, possibly incentives for upperclassmen to live near campus and make room for freshmen, because we do think it's not at all ideal for someone having the college experience for the first time to not be in the middle of it.
So this brings me to a concurrent issue that a lot of people outside of Greater Lafayette might not know about if they're listening to it on one of our other affiliates, which is the city of West Lafayette has done this giant revamping of State Street, trying to essentially create a downtown where none has existed in the city before. And this goes right through the Purdue University campus. And there are something like 3,000 new beds that are going to be created in the next year or two from three giant high-rises that are coming up in the State Street area. And I was going to ask you, do you believe that a majority of those are going to be occupied by Purdue students, which would perhaps lessen the need for the university to have an outlay on new dorms?
Yes. Don't know that what percentage of all those new rooms will be students, but surely a high percentage or a lot will. And we're looking at exactly this issue. You're correct that the projects, privately funded projects, that have already been announced would exceed 3,000 new beds. Now, we've got some very old residence halls here, some of which are really past the end of their life. And we're going to have somewhere in these next few years, we're going to need to take some of those out of service. But we may replace them with additional rooms that we Purdue construct. Part of the 3,000 you mentioned are the new Aspire apartments right on State Street, which is really our project being done in a private partnership. So the new supply will be very large. There will be some offsets from some of our oldest residence halls being phased out. But there's no question that
– But you still expect Purdue is going to have to rebuild some of those itself.
Yeah, and we're discussing right now which ones and how many come out, how many new ones might go in. But there's no question that we'll be in a very different place in 2 or 3 years in terms of the supply and demand of rooms on or right on the edge of campus. But as I mentioned, the success of a couple of our current initiatives has produced a crunch in the near term, and we're very sensitive, as the letter writer suggested we should be, to the need to act on that.
The State Street project also has a big retail component to it. There's going to be retail space in the first or basement floors of a couple of these buildings, and there's going to be a lot of regeneration of retail that comes around that area as well. Purdue is, as people may not know, sort of bankrolling this up front and getting paid back over time by the city of West Lafayette. So what sorts of input do you get as a university into what stores, what merchants you want, what services you want in these areas to try to keep the population there or lure people into these new buildings? Do you get a say with the city in what goes in there?
Right. Like the whole project, it's been collegial all the way. I mean, it's a 50-50 project in terms of dollars in, and we all expect to recoup those dollars over time with the new taxes paid by investments who come in. In terms of the retail itself, I don't know exactly what it'll be, but the short answer to your question is we're all – the city, Purdue, what we're all interested in is retail that will succeed, which is to say that meets the interests and demands of students and neighbors. And what you really want is some combination of these new economic activities that really works, and so that they pay their rent and pay their taxes. Everybody's happy.
I'll tell you what, if you want a statue built in your honor, the first thing you can do, maybe the best thing you could do, is you tear down the Chauncey Hamal and you put up a Trader Joe's. There will be a 22-foot statue of Mitch Daniels if you make that happen.
Well, you can keep the statue, but we're very much in agreement that there's great opportunity. And by the way, it works back to your previous question, Stan. We talked about it before. Part of being a successful residential college 20 years from now will, I believe, have to be what's the overall environment in which the college sits. And that's why we always say that what makes West Lafayette or Lafayette, Greater Lafayette, a more vibrant community is good for Purdue, and what makes Purdue stronger almost certainly contributes to that environment. And so the State Street, call it a joint venture, as far as I know, is unique in America right now, town and gown coming together like that, I think is a direct expression of that intention.
Well, and there was this one rating that got much shared in the last couple of years calling West Lafayette the worst college town in the Big Ten, and certainly not a scientific ranking by any stretch of the imagination, but the idea of that as a lackluster place to come to college could not have helped. So something that you're also trying to work on. Real quick, in our last couple of minutes here, I wanted to know if the university's been able to make any sort of measurement of the monetary gain that either the school or the athletic department got from having played in a bowl game for the first time in several years last month. I was walking from the hotel where I stayed to the game, and as I walked by, I noticed there was a sizable John Purdue Club gathering lots of people in gold and black garb. And so that plus ticket sales and merchandise sales, have you been able at all to quantify this to the university?
I haven't seen a final accounting. The way the bowl thing works, the conference pools its money and shares it. So we were sharing even in the years that we didn't make it to bowl games. So it may be slightly different this year, but that won't be material. I'll tell you what is. As I think you've noticed, we had the biggest attendance increase in Division I during this year. We've sold additional season tickets for next year. Clearly, making it to and then winning a thrilling bowl game gave a boost to all that. So the economics of the bowl games themselves are iffy. In fact, there have been a lot of schools who came out on the short end after they netted out all the travel expenses and
so forth.
Sort of
like hosting the Olympics.
Yes, that's right. You're going to careful what you wish for, but so I think we did better than that. But the real effects, and there'll be very valuable effects, I think, are the second order effects of bringing more excitement, more fans to all our games, and hopefully to future bowl games.
What does that do for the athletic department as a whole? Because we've heard some athletes who are in the non-revenue-generating sports, as they're called, you know, the women's soccer team, the men's golf team, say, hey, you know, in some cases, the full scholarship isn't really a full scholarship. Does this bring in enough revenue to perhaps be able to bolster some of those athletes to keep their educational expenses in check?
Well, we generally pay scholarships through donations of John Purdue Club members, those of us who are part of that, and that'll continue to be our main source for that. But I will say that a strong, self-financed athletic department, which we have had now for many years, it's not new, is something I'm always mention with pride. Too many other schools, most other schools, tax all the students one way or another to support their athletic department. We don't. But anything that makes it stronger is a positive. I'll tell you, those non-revenue sports, we have some of the finest facilities in America. And that's been a part of this legacy that we hope to continue.
All right. Well, as always, we've run out of time before I've run out of questions, so that means there will be stuff for next month's show. This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can find all of these shows archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Purdue University Press, publishing global scholarship and popular regional work since 1960, and featuring the fifth edition of Creating Moments of Joy Along the Alzheimer's Journey, now available. More at thepress.purdue.edu.